Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 85-1129, Paul E. Johnson versus Transportation Agency of Santa Clara County. We'll wait just a moment, Ms. Brooks, till the crowd clears. Proceed whenever you're ready, Ms. Brooks.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case is governed by the principles that were established by this Court in Wygant versus Jackson Board of Education, that before embarking upon a voluntary affirmative action program, a public employer must have convincing evidence that remedial action is warranted, and finding that convincing evidence, develop a remedy which is narrowly tailored. In this case, we have neither convincing evidence that there was a remedial purpose, nor was this remedy narrowly tailored when the Santa Clara County Transportation Agency deprived petitioner Paul Johnson of a well-earned promotion. First, in the ideal world, before developing the program, an employer would look at his workforce statistics, compare them with the relevant labor market, consider if there was other probative evidence of discrimination, and finally, as a third step, eliminate explanations other than discrimination. And these are the kind of explanations that an employer would ordinarily consider in rebutting a Title VII case. But even if the employer doesn't do this at the outset, the employer could certainly do that when the program and an employment action taken under it is challenged. The agency neither went through the process at the beginning, nor was the agency able to come forward with convincing evidence of remedial purpose. The district court heard the corroborating testimony of discrimination.
Well, if a statistical imbalance in the workforce is evident, and they adopt an affirmative action plan, isn't it apparent on its face that it's remedial in the sense they're trying to remedy the imbalance?
Your Honor, they can only remedy that imbalance if, in fact, it is the result of discrimination. First of all,
so you say the statistical imbalance will never justify an affirmative action?
I don't believe that it should, and let me explain why. On one hand, we know that before you embark on an affirmative action program, just good intentions are not enough. On the other hand, we know that we shouldn't require an employer to confess liability under Title VII. Somewhere in between lies the test. And we don't necessarily have the written rule as to what should be sufficient.
What else was there in Weber?
I beg your pardon, specifically?
Beyond an imbalance.
This court took judicial notice that you had other findings of discrimination against the same employer in the same union. And again, it found that the plan itself was sufficiently narrow to justify. But that was the remedial purpose. Here, Your Honor.
You think in Weber it was the plan adopted was to remedy past discrimination?
This court, yes, Your Honor. In this case, however, the job for road dispatcher was not underrepresented with women. And the fact that the agency relied on the fact that there were no women in the skilled craft worker category should have no bearing whatsoever on this promotion.
Do you agree that if the employer has a firm basis for believing remedial action is necessary, because otherwise the employer is likely to be subject to some action against the employer under Title VII, that that justifies or can justify taking affirmative action?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would equate that firm basis with convincing evidence. And what we would require, and which I think is what was the problem here, is that the employer, in developing that firm basis, needs to consider why its statistics are what they are. And there were a number of explanations
All
that
right.
were raised.
Here there was a category of skilled positions.
Yes.
Totaling what, 278 or?
238.
238.
Yes.
None of which were occupied by women.
Yes.
And you think that is not enough for the employer to think that there might be a firm basis here?
In this case, no, because first of all, on the face of the plan and the testimony in the trial, it was conceded that the reason you had zero there was societal and attitudinal and not necessarily discrimination. And specifically, this agency had had an affirmative action program in place for about 5 years. They had been aggressively recruiting and hiring women throughout the workforce. They had been doing the same with minorities, and they had made substantial increases in the numbers. And to infer, again, by 1980, that you had discrimination in the skilled craft worker category that required an employment goal by promotion was simply not correct.
What evidence, or what is the evidence in the record as to the percentage of qualified women in the labor pool for these positions?
Your Honor, when the agency developed this program and when this case was tried, there was no evidence of what the relevant labor pool was. And in fact, the agency relied entirely on the county-wide working force for women, not the labor pool. We offered a petitioner's lodging showing that roughly 7% of the women in this county at that time were in the skilled craft labor jobs.
And the goal that the employer set was only 5%.
No, Your Honor. The goal set at the time the petitioner was denied the promotion was 36.4%. They didn't institute those short-term goals until after petitioner filed suit against the agency. At the time petitioner lost his promotion, the goal was 36.4%.
That, the goal on which we have to test this case, we have to compare it with the 36%.
Certainly with respect to what happened to the petitioner. There's no question they didn't have any short-term goals. If this court is going to go forward with some guidelines, I think that the relevant labor market is the appropriate test. That has to be part of the convincing evidence standard that the court should look at. But the agency needed to go behind those statistics and consider whether that number zero had sources other than affirmative actual discrimination by the employer. We had testimony in the trial that it was attitudinal. The plan itself states that women were, quote, traditionally not employed in the job. The plan doesn't suggest that the tradition had anything to do with the agency's misdeeds. And perhaps more important, we find that the agency had been actively recruiting and bringing women in. And because the agency never kept applicant flow data, we have no idea how many women ever applied for this job. But I think that the factors of the effective affirmative action program, the testimony that they were having trouble recruiting women, necessarily means that no women were applying for this specific job and at this specific time. And before we leave this subject, I think it's very important to point out that in the road dispatcher position specifically, and dispatchers in general, 25% of the agency's employees were women. We were not in, and the relevant labor market at that time was about 22%. So in the narrow focus of what happened to the petitioner and what the agency was doing, there was no remedial purpose whatsoever, and the plan should never have applied to that particular aspect. I think it's also clear that this plan was never narrowly tailored in an important sense. First of all, we're in the promotion situation, not in terms of hiring promotions. And the burden of this plan applied entirely upon the petitioner. We know from the record that the job of road dispatcher did not come open very often. Petitioner had worked for the agency for 13 years, and this job came open only twice. The goals applied throughout the workforce. The goals were not limited to the lower echelon positions. The goals applied whenever an employer was going to make a decision. And this goes into what clearly barred any non-minority employee when he was going up for a promotion and was going head-to-head with an employee that was deemed to be protected under the plan. In this situation, the plan requires that the agency give the protected employee special consideration. And again, this applies throughout the job force. The plan imposes substantial and coercive measures on the agency to be sure and meet his affirmative action goals. If there's an individual manager at the end of the year, he'll be evaluated on whether he met those goals. And finally, there is no provision anywhere in the agency policy to protect the rights of the unprotected employees. And the whole attitude was, the focus was, we're going to give women and minorities special consideration. There was no countervailing balance to say, but wait a minute, you have other employees with this agency with civil rights, and they're entitled to protection also. And as a result, whenever, and again, we don't have applicant flow data, but it is clear that as a matter of course, when an unprotected employee goes up for a promotion with a protected employee, the unprotected employee is going to lose. This is not narrowly tailoring.
I think, just ask another question here. Supposing the plan, it doesn't quite say this, it's kind of vague in general, but supposing there was a provision in the plan that said that if there are any substantial work pools, such as 238 skilled craft positions, and they had described 10 or 15 of them, in which there's absolutely no representation for women, that it shall be an objective of the plan to hire the first qualified woman that applies for that job just to break the line and get some representation. And that was the sole reason given. Would that also be equally invalid?
Your Honor, on these facts, I'd have to say yes, because already we have women actively in the workforce. They'll be in line for promotions in a relatively short period of time.
You're saying promotions always have to be made on merit.
I think that once you've opened the doors and provided for equal opportunity, it's appropriate to have these employees moving up through the workforce based on the merit system.
I agree it's appropriate. Do you think the statute requires that all promotions be made on merit? In the absence of any proof of past discrimination.
Convincing evidence, yes, Your Honor.
And why would the past discrimination change the picture? I understand that the judicial decree really doesn't have any broader power than the employer would have just adopting a new rule.
Your Honor, I think that the reason that it would make a difference to have past discrimination is because we're trying to achieve a reconciliation between the protection that Title VII provides for individual rights and the recognized need to promote voluntary compliance and to achieve the purposes of Title VII, which is equal opportunity and to make people whole if they've suffered discrimination. And we require past discrimination.
You think the Weber case requires proof of past discrimination?
The Weber case, yes. The Weber case had evidence of past discrimination. And in this case, we had no evidence, and indeed an admission in the plan, that any statistical imbalances were attributed to societal attitudes and to traditional norms. And it's probably not a good thing in terms of society, and if we were Congress, perhaps we would want to change that. But again, in terms of bringing women into the workforce, you can't force them into the non-traditional jobs, and if they want those jobs, they can compete on merit, especially because the agency has made effective efforts to recruit them and bring them into the workforce. And that had been very effective in the first 5 years. We were in the second half of the agency's affirmative action program. We were in a second plan. They already had it in place for 3 years, and they rewrote it at the time the petitioner went up for the promotion. I think that there are a lot of other narrower tailing aspects to the plan that are troublesome, and this really focuses on the fact that we're dealing with a promotion rather than hiring, and that is the plan applies employment goals and doesn't take into account that there might be other, less intrusive measures to bring women into the workforce. We already know from the plan, and indeed we're not challenging many aspects of this plan that had good affirmative action programs. We are challenging the application of an employment goal that applied throughout the workforce. And I think there's some aspects of the plan that illustrate how difficult it was. It's a broad plan. It seeks to achieve racial and sexual parity in each job classification. And it goes into substantial detail. In order to achieve this balance for every ethnic group, by Filipinos and by Hispanics and by Asians.
May I just ask again, really it doesn't seem to me under your view of the law that it doesn't make any difference what the plan says, because your client was better qualified than the woman, and that's the end of the case. And there's no past discrimination, and we don't have to know anything else. Why do we even have to look at the plan?
Well, Your Honor, this is just in case you were to find that there was an adequate remedial purpose based solely on these statistics.
Based on statistics, I see.
And, again, we think that that should not be enough, and, again, especially upon the facts of this case. There's another aspect to this. If this court were to find that mere statistical imbalance justified affirmative action employment goals, then it would be very easy for an employer to adopt affirmative action without having any incentive to protect the rights of the other employees. And this basically repeats a prima facie test, which this court has applied for Title VII plaintiffs as opposed to Title VII defendants. And because the employer has the information, and because the employer has a dual responsibility to both his non-minority and his minority employees, I think it is appropriate to require more of the employer. But we're not going to require that he confess liability. It has to be somewhere in the middle.
A promotion is involved in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
How about a hiring? Do you think an employer may adopt a race-conscious hiring policy, establish a goal of 3-to-1 or 2-to-1?
Yes, Your Honor.
Just because he wants to?
No. The answer is yes, he may, but only when he has convincing evidence that there's a remedial purpose and he's determined that
you would make the same argument with respect to a hiring goal.
Yes, but I think that the latter aspect goes to the tailoring aspect. When you're in the hiring situation, you're able to diffuse the burden that you're applying. You know, you have a pool of applicants, and you're looking for...
Yes, but you nevertheless would say that just because the employer wants to isn't enough.
That's
and
absolutely
just
correct.
Because there's a racial imbalance isn't enough.
No, it shouldn't be.
Right.
We need more. And this is because Title VII protects all employees from discrimination in employment by race and sex.
Ms. Brooks, I want to be very sure. Tell me again why this case isn't a straightforward application of the Weber case.
The first answer, there are a number of answers. I think the first is this court limited Weber to public employers, but that really begs your question. I think the second answer is because we're not able to diffuse. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. I meant Weber applied only to private, and we're a public employer.
But you say that isn't really a very good distinction.
Well, I think it begs your question because you can always extend Weber to a public employer. I think that there. I didn't mean to make a joke. That's within your power. But I think there's a more important distinction because in Weber, you were able to diffuse the burdens. Weber dealt with a new training program that benefited both black and white employees. And everyone was going to have something new, and you didn't have the kind of expectations that had been developed in the workforce. Whereas in this case, you had a relatively small county workforce. You had low turnover, which is in the face of the plan. You had employees with certain promotion expectations that if they worked hard, they'd be judged on merit. And again, to apply affirmative action in this case without being sure that you have convincing evidence of a remedial purpose and that you can narrowly limit your application, you simply can't do that. Here it would fall entirely on the petitioner's shoulders, and it did.
Ms. Brooks, you're at pains not to require the employer to come in and confess that that he's been discriminating in the past, but I just wonder how secure your assurance is. He doesn't have to come in and say, I've been guilty of discrimination in the past, but in order to defend against a suit by the non-minority employee who hasn't been promoted, he's going to say, well, you know, I'm not saying I was, but I may have been, right? He has to come in and put in that evidence, leaving himself open to later suits by people who say, well, he didn't say he was, but he said he may have been. And to prove that he may have been, he confessed this, this, and this, right?
I mean, I think there are a number of answers to that. First, in undergoing a process before adopting the affirmative action program, the employer is able to have evidence, you know, a process that he went through and to be able to come forward. So it immediately takes him off the really dangerous point in the tightrope. He's got some protection. But in doing the evidentiary process to develop a basis for your plan, the employer is not necessarily required to prove to a certainty that he's discriminated.
No, just that he may have been discriminated.
Exactly.
Right.
But I think that that's
no employer's going to like to do that. I mean, you're just developing evidence for somebody else to use in a later suit against you.
Well, Your Honor, no person may not be able to do it, but Title VII says that you cannot discriminate against your employees. And you have to have some kind of credible basis. That was the holding in Wygant.
It does seem to me to put the employer between a rock and a hard place. In order to validate his plan, he has to show that there's a likelihood, potentiality, or what? Something that he's discriminated in the past.
The kind of evidence that we're talking about, and again, this is only some ideas, would be to look at the statistics and give a careful scrutiny to the statistics. In this case, the agency used the wrong relevant labor market. As Justice O'Connor pointed out, they never even looked at the real relevant labor market. And in fact, it's very interesting because this issue came up when they rewrote that plan in 1978. And the director testified at trial, well, someone raised it, but we really never got too far. So first of all, what we're asking for is a statistical scrutiny, which by itself should not expose the employer. Second, he looks for some kind of explanation for these statistics other than discrimination. This is a process that he would ordinarily go through in defending a Title VII case. I think it's an appropriate process just as an employer. It's not that burdensome. And if he finds that there's discrimination and he looks for other corroborative evidence, it doesn't have to be specific acts. But we're talking about sort of a minimal effort to ensure that when you've got a plan, you've got a good basis for that plan. And by even doing this minimal effort, you're in a much better position to identify what you need to remedy and how to remedy it. It's a process. It has an underlying substance, but I don't think that employers would necessarily be discouraged in doing that. And it's got, and again, in order to protect people like Petitioner, who otherwise do have their rights lost, the employer has to do something more than just throw out statistics.
What would you say the prevailing law is or was in the lower courts with respect to whether racial imbalance alone would make out a prima facie case under Title VII?
I think if you're a Title VII case, Title VII plaintiff, excuse me, I don't think there's any question that that is a prima facie case. But again, and I think this is
well,
the question.
If you're, yeah, how about if you're just a court?
Okay.
Not the plaintiff, but what about the...
The prevailing law
the,
is...
The plaintiff gets through with his case or her case, and the only proof is racial imbalance. And there's a motion to dismiss.
Then that would be denied, Your Honor, because statistical imbalances, if there's no explanation, do establish a case. And that really was, I believe, Judge Wallace's dissent. And we think that it was a very good point, which is when an employer has developed an affirmative action plan and is going forward to discriminate against non-minority employees pursuant to that plan, he's not asserting a non-discriminatory reason.
If that makes out a prima facie case in a Title VII case, just racial imbalance, what's the employer then? How can he win the case? By proving there isn't racial imbalance or proving that what? That there's no racial discrimination?
The employer can come forward with a number of uh-huh. explanations, and particularly I believe this court held in the Cooper case, that you can explain the statistical imbalance by reasons other than no discrimination. Again, in Wygant, this court held that mere past history of racial discrimination is not enough.
What if the employer who has a racially imbalanced workforce asks his attorney, if I am sued, he says, there's a racially imbalanced workforce, and that would survive a motion to dismiss in a Title VII suit. Should I do something about it?
Or yes,
should
and that's
I,
precisely...
No, wait a minute.
Oh,
wait
I'm
a minute.
Sorry.
Should I also ask you, what are the chances of the plaintiff winning? You look around, and do you think that I might lose a Title VII case?
And that's exactly why having the employer consider statistical imbalances and look for explanations and then take a remedy before he gets sued would solve the problem. I would like to reserve the rest of my time.
Did you just give away your case or not?
No, I don't think we gave away our case at all, because here the agency never did that kind of a process. The agency never considered other explanations, and we raised those other explanations in the trial. We showed that women were not applying.
You mean it never asked, might I lose a Title VII case?
The agency has claimed that they would, and I don't think that they would on these facts, because the plan shows that the lack of women was attitudinal, that the agency was affirmatively hiring.
Thank you, Ms. Brooks. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Woodside.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I'd like to begin by answering the questions that Justice White just posed and tell you what my advice to my clients would have been under these circumstances. With no women out of 238 skilled craft workers, with only one woman working on the road crews, with evidence of practices that job descriptions were male-oriented only and specifically stated that these jobs...
Now you're putting some other facts in the question. Let's just stick to a racial imbalance.
Very well, Your Honor. With those statistics of no women in the skilled craft workforce and only one woman out of 110 road workers, I think there would clearly be a prima facie case.
And you think that just regularly in the district courts that evidence would survive
a motion to dismiss? Absolutely, Your Honor.
But it wouldn't mean the employer would necessarily lose the case.
It would not mean that the employer would necessarily lose. We would have then the burden of articulating non-discriminatory reasons for this particular imbalance. And I think on the facts of this case, which are in this record, we would have not been able to meet that burden.
Well, but do you think the employer shouldn't adopt a policy just based on racial imbalance, but that he should say, have I got a good chance of actually losing the case?
No, I believe that if there is evidence of a prima facie case of discrimination, that's enough for an employer to consider.
Well, that means just racial imbalance.
That means racial imbalance. That's right.
You needn't go on and say, well, I think I can still win because I have a neutral explanation.
Well, as I tried to make clear with the facts of this case.
I know, but forget these facts. But
right.
You think the employer need not go on and say that I do or I don't have a neutral explanation?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And the reason I say that is that these kinds of statistical imbalances put the employer between the rock and the hard place that Justice Scalia referred to earlier.
What if the employer knows that no woman has ever applied for any of these jobs, that it's just the kind of job that, for some reason, women in that area have not applied for?
I think
Is that something the employer must weigh in addition to statistics?
I don't think it's required that the employer must weigh that, but your question suggests that if the employer knew that factor, I think that would make it a much closer case. That factor is not present in this case.
Who's going to know if the employer doesn't? Presumably the employer is the one that receives job applications.
That's correct, Your Honor. And given the liberal rules of discovery, in this case, had the petitioner sought to pursue that line of inquiry, the petitioner could have done so. It was not pursued. And indeed, the question of whether...
Then it really boils down to the burden of proof, in a sense, doesn't it? I mean, if the burden was on you in that situation, it wasn't up to the... plaintiff, but if the burden was on the plaintiff, then the plaintiff should have discovered.
I think that's correct, given those limited facts and the limited hypothetical that Justice O'Connor...
Mr. Woodside,
yes.
I was under the impression that the district court found that there had never been any discrimination against women by the agency, and that none was occurring at the time of the trial.
That, Your Honor, was not a litigated issue in the case.
It did make that finding.
The district court judge did make that finding.
Did the Court of Appeals hold it clearly erroneous?
No, the Court of Appeals did not hold that clearly erroneous.
So you rely solely on the statistics?
I rely on the statistics as well as evidence of other practices. And I think that finding was of no discrimination was the wrong finding to be entered in such a case. The relevant inquiry, it seems to me, should be whether or not the employer believed and had a firm basis to conclude that it may have discriminated against women based on its own knowledge of the statistics.
But don't we have to accept the findings as they come to us?
Yes, Your Honor, you do. And I'm not suggesting that that finding be reversed as clearly erroneous, but I think it was not one which was litigated. There was nobody at the trial court pointing the finger at the transportation agency and saying, you, in fact, discriminated against women. That was not litigated. I certainly was not going to stand up and concede discrimination against women.
What would you clarify for me what the affirmative action plan consisted of? Was it a plan to be geared to the percentage of women in the county-wide workforce for every kind of position?
There are.
Or was it geared to the number of women qualified for these technical jobs in this particular category?
It actually has elements of both, Your Honor. There was a general overall goal set forth in the 1978 plan that for each job in each job category, the goal would be that all job categories would be comprised of women, minorities, and others approximately in proportion to their numbers in the county labor pool. That's in the surrounding
county. So you concede, then, that this employer affirmative action plan was not geared to the number of qualified women in the pool of
labor? No, Your Honor, I don't concede that, because the next step, and probably the most important step in our plan, is that after those overall goals were set, the plan further requires that specific goals be thereafter set for individual jobs, such as skilled craft. And Your Honor correctly pointed out that there was a goal set for skilled craft of only 3 women out of 55 expected new hires in 1982.
Where do we find that? I confess that it was difficult for me in these opinions to know what it was that the affirmative action plan really consisted of in that regard, as applied to these jobs.
The agency's goal is contained in the 1982 plan.
Is that in the appendix someplace?
Yes,
where,
it is, Your Honor.
Where would I find
it? Yes, it is.
In the appendix?
Yes, it
Don't
is.
Don't take your argument time. I want to know where I can find it.
It is in the joint appendix, and it is cited. The specific reference is cited in our brief, Your Honor. That specific goal of 3 out of 55 was the goal for the skilled craft job.
Was that the goal that was applied when Mr. Johnson was denied his promotion?
There was at that time no specific goal for skilled craft.
So at that time they were using the countywide pool.
They were using the countywide pool as a reference.
But that's the case we're trying, right? We're not trying somebody else who came up after there was a 3 out of 55 requirement.
That's correct.
Somebody who came up when there was a what, 30% requirement?
The long-term goal was 36.4%.
So it seems to me your response to Justice O'Connor is utterly irrelevant to this case.
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I think—
This is Mr. Johnson's case, I thought, and he's complaining about being denied a promotion.
He is, Your Honor. But the plan does more than simply state there shall be a fixed number of women in any particular job. The plan sets absolutely no quota. The plan establishes no fixed preference. It simply says, given those numbers, the director of the agency should give consideration to that disparity, the absence of women, for example, in making hiring or promotion decisions.
I don't understand. You're saying he was not applying a 30% quota?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. That is the long-term goal. That is the long-term goal.
When Mr. Johnson's case came up for promotion, was the agency applying a 30% quota or not?
Quota? No, there was no quota.
Goal?
Long-term goal, yes. Long-term goal, yes. I think it's important, Your Honor, that the long-term goal, which was later refined to be more specific for women in skilled craft, that long-term goal did not require any fixed preference to be given. Indeed, everyone who wished a promotion could compete for a promotion. Unlike what the Petitioner's Counsel has just said earlier, there is no evidence to indicate that in every case women would get the promotion. Indeed, the facts are to the contrary.
Well, Mr. Brooks, is it your position that the county, as an employer, can set an affirmative action plan goal that is geared to the number of women in the labor force in the county generally, as opposed to the number of qualified women in the available pool?
Yes, Your Honor.
That an affirmative action plan geared to the larger percentage is valid?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, in this case, I think the reason why that is valid is that under the case law decided by this court, one would ordinarily expect in jobs throughout an agency that they would be comprised, absent discrimination, of roughly their numbers that exist in the general labor pool.
Is that right?
Yes.
You mean it is statistically reasonable to expect as many women to be working on road crews and to believe that if there aren't that proportion, there must be discrimination afoot?
I think,
as there are to think that there are women working?
I think that there would be an inference of discrimination drawn from that factor
alone. What is that based on? Human experience or some governmental policy?
I think it is based on both human experience and governmental policy.
On human experience?
Yes, Your Honor. I think women do seek these jobs.
In this country?
Yes. If I may, Your Honor, the suggestion that's made by the Petitioner's Counsel for the first time in this case is that the relevant labor pool was 7%, or 5%, as she stated in the reply brief. If that is the case, and it's too bad that that was not litigated at trial or not even mentioned at the Court of Appeals, but if that is the case, then it's clear from those numbers alone that there would have been a case of discrimination against the agency. The difference between zero, which is what we have here, and 5% or 7% or any of the higher figures makes us vulnerable to a charge of discrimination and gives us good cause, it seems to me, to take remedial action.
Without even considering at all whether you can bring forward any patently valid justification for the statistical discrepancy. For instance, the relevant pool is not all women working in the county, but rather women working in this particular craft or this particular area.
Well, I think
without even considering that, you're entitled to say, oh, we're at risk for a discrimination suit. And we can immediately begin discriminating on the basis of race or sex in our promotion and hiring.
I don't think I would say you can immediately begin to discriminate. The plan says that fact should be considered in the hiring and promotion decisions. It should be considered. It's not necessarily determinative. And at the time of this decision, there were absolutely no women in the skilled craft jobs. Those were the facts known to the agency director at the time. And that was the basis upon which he made his decision.
Well, he not only considered it, he did promote a less qualified woman over a better qualified man.
Well, the district court did make that finding with respect to qualifications.
Well, that's the case that's the case that is now here.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would point out that the agency director testified that in his view they were equally qualified.
And could I ask you, what do you think our cases last term held with respect to what circumstances justify giving relief to a non-victim?
I think that your case is held that in the context of the problem that we have here is that where there is a firm basis upon which an employer can infer that its own practices may have been discriminatory, then the employer can voluntarily take affirmative action which is not victim-specific. And I would cite primarily the Wygant case.
Our case has said that the circumstances must evidence particularly egregious instances of discrimination?
I don't think the case law says it has to be particularly egregious. I think the case law suggests that where there are facts that suggests there would be a prima facie case of discrimination, the employer can voluntarily embark on an affirmative action.
Because you wouldn't suggest that there was any evidence here of egregious discrimination, would you?
There was no such finding, Your Honor. But there was, and I think it's important to remember that the statistics were buttressed at trial by evidence of the agency's own
practice. But the lady who was, a woman who was promoted was not a victim of discrimination.
Well, the district court made one finding that's interesting. He suggested that one of the interview panelists may have had discriminatory intent against her because she was a woman, but that that by itself did not justify the action taken. So I think even the district court judge conceded that under the facts presented here, there was evidence that she may have been deterred and, in fact,
not fairly. If that were the case, none of you would really be here.
If the district judge had made the finding that she had, in fact, been discriminated against, yes, I think you're correct, Your Honor.
Let me make sure I understand the sweep of your argument, Mr. Woodside. If I understood your answer to Justice White correctly, you're asserting that a government always has the right to institute a plan that permits discrimination in hiring and in promotion on the basis of race or sex whenever its workforce does not contain the same proportion of race, that minority race, or that sex, as the workforce at large. Is that it?
I think that...
That alone is enough to show, that statistical disparity is enough to justify an affirmative action plan, that is to say, discrimination by the government on the basis of race.
If those differences that you describe are statistically significant, in other words, if the difference between...
Now you're hedging it. I mean, I was bringing in statistical significance in my earlier question, that the mere fact that the work pool in general contains 30% women doesn't necessarily mean that this particular craft or trade or occupation should have 30% women. And you rejected that. You said it's enough if working women constitute 30% of the workforce.
I think that raises the question as to whether or not the practices in the agency itself have been fair toward women. And under our plan...
Now you sound like the other side. Now you're saying that it isn't enough to just have a statistical disparity, that the employer has to have some reason to believe that the statistical disparity is a result of discrimination.
I understood your earlier question to mean that any time there's a disparity between a workforce and the labor market generally, would that constitute a prima facie case of discrimination? My answer to that is yes.
And justify immediate implementation of an affirmative action plan.
That's right. And it would be up to the petitioner to prove that there's an alternative explanation for those statistical imbalances.
But they're trying to prove that here, and you're saying it's irrelevant.
No, they never tried.
You're saying that your client was authorized to institute the affirmative action plan because of the statistical imbalance.
But against a challenge, it would be up to the petitioner to prove that it would be reasonable to have no women in the skilled craft category. And there was not a shred of evidence.
No, not no women, just not necessarily to impose 30% women.
But
that's what your plan was.
The plan set a long-term goal. I want to emphasize that. It set a long-term goal. The factors that the agency director cited when he made the decision was the absence of women in the skilled craft category. That's really the salient fact in this case. We don't have before the court a case where there were several women in the job and it was another promotion down the line that was at issue. The strong point in the agency's plan here is that it calls for a case-by-case review in hiring and promotion to look at the statistics as you find them at that point in time. And to me, the very important factor in this case is that this was the first time a woman got a skilled craft job, and she didn't get it because there was a quota. She got it because there
she
was...
She didn't get it because she was better qualified. That's
She was certainly well qualified, and as the district court judge found...
What percentage did women then make up of the particular category of job after her promotion?
After her promotion? I can cite to you some record statistics that between 1978 and 1982, there was an increase of 111 skilled craft workers. And of those 111 additional jobs, six were women. So she was the first, and there were five more out of another 110. So this was not the kind of plan where the agency gave, as has been suggested, an automatic preference for women. It simply did not occur here. The agency's action was moderate, and it was handled on a case-by-case basis, given the facts known at the time of each decision. And that's a fluid situation, I would submit, because as we learned more about this job and looked at it more closely, the goal for the job was refined to, incidentally, about between 5 and 6% women to be hired for the expected new openings.
Mr. Woods, I'm puzzled when you say that this was not a case of an automatic preference for a woman. But that's the only reason she got the job.
Oh, it's not the only reason, Your Honor. She was.
I mean, the only reason he didn't get it, then, put it the other way around.
That became the decisive factor. If I can explain, the county's rules require that hiring or promotion decisions be made from a list, a civil service list, of the top 7 applicants for the job. She was one of those top 7 applicants. And if there was nothing said about sex in this case, any of those top 7 could have been appointed. And I would submit if the agency director just simply said, I liked her better and appointed her, that would probably be the end of it. But it is clear.
But that's not what happened.
Well, he did state that became a factor in the decision-making process.
Yeah, but until she registered a complaint with the affirmative action section, that she was out. Isn't that correct?
Apparently, she was out even before the second round of interviews, according to her testimony. Mr. Johnson apparently had the inside track.
I don't know. Maybe. I just don't understand how you can say this is not an automatic preference.
Well, what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is that there is no automatic preference to be accorded women. These cases are to be...
Well, do you think it would be a violation of the statute if the county said in departments where there are 238 men... and you get a qualified woman that comes in, let's automatically give her some favor, better consideration than we would give a man.
On these facts, I do not think that would be a violation. I'm trying to illustrate.
You're just saying that's not this case.
That's correct. I think this case is more subtle. I think this case involves, as I stated earlier, a case-by-case review of employment decisions.
Mr. Johnson, who had his eye on this job for some time, apparently, and had taken a demotion and worked in a lower-paying job for several years in order to obtain better qualifications in order to get this promotion. He competed head-to-head with the woman who ultimately got the job. He was selected and would have gotten the job, but for the fact of the affirmative action program, she had been rated less qualified and was given the job in preference to him solely by reason of the affirmative action plan. Isn't that the facts of the case?
I think you could summarize it that way, Your Honor, but I would not want to omit the fact that Ms. Joyce also competed for this job. Ms. Joyce, in 1974, applied for the road dispatcher job. She was told at the time that she was not qualified. She then went and worked on the road crews themselves for 5 years, which incidentally was twice as long as Mr. Johnson did, so that by 1980, when they were competing head-to-head, as you put it, both of them were well qualified to perform the work. And the scores that were arrived at in this case, based on an interview alone, without a test or formal procedure, show them to be but 2 points apart.
And he had served in the job.
Pardon?
He had served in the job previously, hadn't he?
He, without competing with anyone else.
That's right. Serving above his grade, but on an acting basis.
On an acting basis, without competing with anyone for that job. There's no question but that there are competing interests here. And it would seem to me that this court would want to allow appointing authorities and employers throughout the country to make decisions which they believe are in their best interests and are fair as can possibly be made to all concerned. In this case,
anytime an employer wants to adopt a race-conscious hiring or promotion policy, that should be permitted.
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor.
Well, he thinks it's fair. That's what you said.
No,
he thinks it would be in his best interest. That's what you said.
I think because of the statistics that were in this case and because of the evidence of practices that women had been excluded from training opportunities in the past, that the agency had refused to hire pregnant women and the like, given those facts, that it's permissible to engage
Well, you're adding something in the balance besides a racial imbalance. But that's...
Yes, but I believe those are the facts here. And I tried and I endeavored to answer your question if we were only dealing with racial sex imbalance. But I think there is more in this case. That's what I wish.
My concern, Mr. Woodside, is not about preventing employers from doing what they think is best for the workforce. What I'm concerned about is that, to go back to the rock and the hard place analogy, the employer is faced with a possibility, and state employers in particular, of getting caught with affirmative action suits.
Yes.
And one way to avoid being between the rock and the hard place is to put Mr. Johnson between you and the rock. And that's the risk. That's the risk that occurs here. In order to avoid all possibility of an affirmative action suit, it's very easy for an employer to say, well, why should I worry about my skin? I'll just adopt an affirmative action program, discriminate against Mr. Johnson or anybody else on hiring, and that's perfectly lawful, and simply appeal to statistical disparity. I'm not worried about his doing it for the good of the workforce. He'll do it for the good of the employer. I mean, that's the way people are normally motivated.
Well, I think it was done for the good of the workforce. And also there was an effort made to be fair in the way this plan was designed. This plan was not designed to make, to have, for example, as was discussed in the case earlier this morning, a one-for-one hiring quota. It's not like the Weber plan, which stated that there shall be a 50% set-aside for black workers in the Kaiser plan. This case called for a case-by-case consideration, and as applied, it meant that there were very few women who actually benefited from the affirmative action plan, but a few did. And we think that that's the type of moderate, sensible approach that this court should endorse.
Could I ask, did you say that some goals have been refined to, say, 5 or 6%?
Yes, Your Honor.
In what, these skills categories?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, suppose that prior to the adoption of your plan, you had looked around and you had said, well, there's 30% of women in the workforce in the county, but we only have 6% in these jobs. There's really a statistically significant imbalance. Now, under your argument, I take it they could have adopted a disaffirmative action plan.
I think carried it out, except
that one of these days you really discover that you made a mistake. Should have only been 5 or 6% is plenty.
I understand, and that would be a harder, much a closer case, Your Honor. But I think the facts here cannot be emphasized any greater than that there were zero women. That's the real important factor in this case. I think this case illustrates well the difficulty that employers, public or private alike, have in meeting their obligations under Title VII to both prohibit discriminatory practices on the one hand and on the other hand to really try to effectuate and provide remedies where employers believe discrimination may have occurred. I think we have the facts here that discrimination may have occurred, that statement was made in the 1978 Affirmative Action Plan, and I think the agency should be entitled to take the modest steps that it has done in this case.
Let me just ask one more question. I've still been trying to figure out the answer to one Justice O'Connor asked you a while ago. You have an employer that employs 238 people.
Yes.
No women in the workforce at all.
Yes.
He knows that no woman has ever applied. He's never discriminated. He knows that to be a fact. Under your interpretation, he cannot decide that he would like to hire a few women in order to minimize the risk of suit or just because he thinks it's a healthy thing to do. Whereas somebody who knows he has discriminated in the past can adopt an affirmative action program.
Well, it seems to me that in the question that you've asked, the absence of any women and the absence of women applicants may not answer the question whether or not there's been discrimination. It may be that the employer's
My hypothesis is whatever facts are relevant, he knows there's just has never been any discrimination here. They were isolated, whatever the reasons might be. But I gather, in your view, he could not adopt an affirmative action program.
Well, if it were shown that he knew there was absolutely no discrimination, that he, the employer, knew that.
He did all the hiring himself, and he knows he never had any applications.
I don't think he could.
Well, even though that would make out a
prima facie case of employment discrimination.
Well, that's the difficulty. Under the hypothetical that Justice Stevens has asked, he's suggesting there is no prima facie case because
that under your view of the law,
the plaintiff would, all he'd have to do is to show that imbalance. And that would survive a motion to dismiss, and then the employer would be on the, would have to prove no discrimination.
Then he's suggesting further that the explanation for that imbalance is no women have ever applied. And what I'm saying...
That's a defense of the prima facie case.
Yes.
And I thought you'd been saying that so long as there's a prima facie case, he can institute an affirmative action plan.
Yes. And I tried to answer...
You should have given a different answer to Justice Stevens.
I'm sorry. The closer we get...
Me too. I should have asked Justice Scalia.
I have nothing further to add. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Woodside. Ms. Brooks, do you have something that you wish to say? You have 4 minutes left.
I just have a few points to respond to. I think that the facts of this case show why we would suggest that an employer has to show more than a prima facie case before he adopts a voluntary affirmative action plan. And by prima facie case, I'm talking about a negative statistical balance. Because here the agency clearly never went behind and considered whether no women had ever applied. It's not quite correct to say the petitioner didn't ask for applicant flow data. It was requested during discovery, and we were told it wasn't available because the county never got the computer programs. That's really not here or there, but I do want to make it clear that we did look for applicant flow data, and we're told it just wasn't available.
Ms. Brooks, can you explain one thing to me that I'm a little... What difference does it make whether the proper proportion in this particular labor pool, if we're playing statistics, was 30% or 5%? What difference does it make inasmuch as there were no women in this job category at the time anyway? Even if the proper percentage were 5% instead of 30%, presumably in implementing the affirmative action plan, the employer would have been justified in preferring this woman.
We don't agree that the employer would have been justified in preferring the woman because if you looked at the road dispatcher job, you had 20% of the employees, 3 out of 18, were already women at the time, so the plan should never have applied. But if you look at the plan in general, the fact that they never looked for a relevant labor market goes to the overall crudity of the affirmative action plan. You don't have an employer here who made a good faith effort to develop a plan. You have an employer who basically looked at the overall population, slapped some numbers in, and then went forward, again, without taking into account the rights of the other employees. That's why it's relevant, because this plan is facially discriminatory with respect to all of the unprotected employees. And that's
you don't believe there's a harmless error rule? That is, that even if the employer had used the right percentages, an affirmative action plan based on that would have justified preference to this?
Not in this case, because there are other explanations for the statistical disparity, and in fact you find these in the county's own documents. They admit that they attribute the lack of women here not to, quote, past discrimination. They attribute it to societal attitudes. And I don't think that this court has ever held that women will necessarily occupy the same jobs in direct proportion to their representation in the working force. I think it's rather obvious that women and men prefer things differently. I'm not saying that that's always good, but attitudes based on sex are different. And I think it's an important factor here that you have women apply for non-traditional jobs in the transit agency and getting them. You had extensive hiring in terms of women bus drivers and women utility workers, which was the position below becoming a mechanic. I think what you have here is an explained statistical disparity in that women were going into other jobs and choosing not to work for the roads division, where you had fewer openings and less future opportunity for advancement. But we don't know because this agency never looked and never considered other alternatives than their assumption that they discriminated. And we say that's wrong, and that's why you should have more than just a prima facie case when we talk about convincing evidence that it is appropriate to go into a voluntary affirmative action plan. I think there's another factor here.
Your time has expired, Ms.
Thank you very much.
The case is submitted. We'll resume at 1 o'clock.